For her birthday, Corwin took his favorite sister for a magic carpet ride of her own, once around Republic City by Sky Bison, with Cora along to point out landmarks and items of interest. Then they were off to an old haunt for a dinner of their own. Naruk's Seaweed Noodlery was a bustling restaurant in the heart of the Little Water Tribe district, and a much less fancy sort of place than Kwong's. For all that he had enjoyed his evening there with Utna, Corwin would have had to admit that Naruk's was much more his style. And hers, come to think about it. He made a mental note to bring her by soon. No obsequious head waiter here, nor any dress code beyond that required by law. It didn't even have tablecloths. What it had was a battle-scarred counter along one wall, three rows of sturdy square tables, and a cheerful staff who greeted the trio with boisterous cries of welcome. Hanging behind the counter was a large, framed, slightly age-faded poster of Cora in her pro-bending days, her arms folded across her chest, looking sassy and confident. In the upper right corner, in a bold, black-markered hand, she'd signed it, translated from the Tongyu. "I'm Avatar Cora, and this is my favorite noodlery in Republic City." As such, it was even less of a shock than usual that the staff knew her on sight. But the two waitresses and the burly head cook surprised and pleased Caitlin by recognizing her and Corwin as well, and welcoming them like long-lost friends. One of the waitresses actually shooed another group of customers away from the corner table where Cora customarily sat. They gave the place up willingly enough when they saw that one of the people they were being evicted for was the Avatar. But Corwin and Kate both suspected that wasn't the reason the staff were doing it. They were doing it because she was a regular customer of very long standing, and the people getting booted from her table were just some random MLB team. Anne and Azana joined them just as they were getting situated, having caught the streetcar over from Azana's apartment. The latter tried, as a matter of form, to excuse herself at that point, having seen their mutual student safely to the appointment, but Kate wouldn't hear of it. "Don't be silly, Azana-sensei," she said cheerfully. "Please, if you've no other plans this evening, join us." "Thank you, Master Caitlin," said Azana with a cordial smile. "I'd be happy to. But I don't think we need to be so formal on your birthday, do we?" Her smile turned into a grin. "Or any other time we're not in a dojo, for that matter. Just call me Azana." "In that case, you'd better call me Kate," Caitlin replied. In the reshuffle this necessitated, Cora's usual table was nominally a foretop. Corwin ended up more or less cornered, hemmed in between the wall behind him, a half-wall which served as a border for the seating area to his right, and Cora to his left, with Kate and Anne on the other side and Azana at the end. Once everyone was resettled and their starting orders in, Cora dragged up the messenger bag she wore and set it on the table, then opened the flap and started rummaging inside it. "Well, Kate, I've missed a few birthdays," she said wryly, "but I think this'll make a start on making up for it." So saying, she pulled out a couple of large books. "This," she went on, sliding the first across, "is the complete libretto and score to the classical version of Love Amongst the Dragons, which is the only version, as far as I'm concerned," she added with a wink.
"Oh, thank you," said Kate, picking up the book and leafing through it. "I might get together with the drama department at NAU and try staging it this fall. I'm sure Professor Ford would be interested."
Cora's grin widened. "I look forward to the complete bewilderment of your students, then," she said. "And this," she added, tapping the leather-bound cover of the second, larger volume, "is a book I promised I'd track down for you, what, 7 years ago? Ironically, because it's so late,
I can now present it to you as the work of one of your peers. Master Caitlin, I give you the one and only standard language edition of The Spirit and the Sword by the great Master Pian Dao. With a sound of delight, Kate took up the leather-bound book and opened it to the title page, her eyes widening as she saw the neatly calligraphed lettering there. "It's handwritten," she said. How can Master Pian Dao have known standard? Lazana wondered. He lived in the time of Avatar Aang, long before contact with Zupang. He didn't, Korra told her. As a matter of fact, unbeknownst to me, no standard edition of any of his works existed when I promised Kate I'd get that book for her. She grinned again. So I had to make one. Translated it myself. Wow, said Azana, impressed. And I thought reading it in school was hard work. Still grinning, Korra hooked an arm around Corwin's neck and mussed his hair. Ask the boy wonder here. When I do presents, I don't fool around. It's true, Corwin agreed. A moment later, one of the waitresses, a middle-aged water tribeswoman with a beaming smile, appeared, greeting them, as she had when they'd entered, like heroes returning from a long war. Welcome back, she said cheerfully to Corwin. Been a long time. What can I get you? Corwin smiled and said, Long indeed, Nalka. Good to be back at last. He picked up a menu card from the little wooden box of them in the middle of the table and glanced down it, confirming his suspicion that nothing much had changed. I think I... he began, and then Korra interrupted him with an elbow. Super noodle bowl, she prompted. What? Super noodle bowl, Korra repeated mischievously. Corwin regarded her with an entirely fake expression of cool appraisal and replied, Correct me if I'm wrong, but are you asking for a challenge? Korra responded to this with nothing more than a slightly devilish grin, so Corwin turned back to Nelka and said, I'll have the super noodle bowl, and some of those fried dumplings. And for you, Avatar? Nelka asked, playing the game to perfection. You know, I think I'll have the super noodle bowl, said Korra, as if she'd just thought of it. The super noodle bowl turned out to be just about what it said, a large wooden bowl, mostly full of Naruk's signature green seaweed-infused noodles, with some hot chicken shark broth poured over them and a few chopped scallions scattered on top. Corwin's and Korra's arrived together mere moments later, placed simultaneously in front of them both by a broadly smiling Nelka, who informed the others that their own orders would be out soon. Ready to lose, Rocket Boy? Asked Korra as she snapped her chopsticks apart and prepared to dig in. Doing the same, Corwin rolled his eyes and intoned in a deeper than usual voice, Your powers are weak, old woman. Oh, it's on now, said Korra, grinning. Right then, Corwin said, picking up his bowl with his free hand. Korra did likewise. They glanced at each other with matching, wicked little smiles, and then Corwin warned the others at the table, This isn't going to be big on dignity. And indeed it wasn't. For the name of the game with Super Noodle Bowl Challenge appeared to be eating all the noodles in the bowl in a single uninterrupted go, and the one viable strategy for that was to shovel up the biggest possible wad of them with the chopsticks and then slurp as if the fate of the galaxy were at stake. People at neighboring tables paused to look, some craning their necks. Had it gone on for more than the few seconds it took, Anne suspected betting pools might have started. The tail end of Corwin's noodles vanished with a final broth-shedding flick, perhaps half a second before Korra's. With all that on board, he barely had room to chew, but chew he did, putting paid to a whole bowl load of green pasta in record time. Swallowing with a look of triumph, he tipped his head back and poured the remaining broth down after it, then banged the bowl down on the table and cried, "Ha! I win!" Cora, still chewing, gave him a venomous look made doubly comical by her bulging cheeks, then finished off her own bowl at a less frantic pace and put the empty down next to his. "This is no longer a fair competition," she declared petulantly. "Look at the size of your jaw." Corwin cocked a hand theatrically next to his ear. "What's that I hear? It sounds like the faint and distant mewling of someone who has lost." "Stupid Viking jeans," Cora grumbled, unable to make it convincing by masking her smile. "I think they're so big." "You two are disgusting," Kate laughed. "Hey, be glad we're not at the old Republic Apothecary soda fountain," said Corwin. "Man, they tore that place down," Cora exclaimed. "Aw, no way," cried Corwin. "Way, 2-3 years ago, to put up a bank." Cora folded her arms, her scowl less put on now. "I'm sure they waited until I was out of town." "Jerks," said Corwin. "I know," Cora agreed. Then, sighing, she went on, "Just goes to show you, I guess, the Avatar dined here is not a guaranteed spot on the Historic Places Register." "What about this place?" Anne wondered. Cora laughed. "Ha! They wouldn't just have to worry about me. They'd have everybody in Major League bending after them if anything happened to Narooks," she said. "Particularly the Spider Wolves. Those guys are creepy." The rest of the meal unfolded in similar style, with a lot of laughter and goodwill. It struck Anne that they'd had a lot of meals like that since coming to Dicho. But this was different from the others, because there were few of them here, and it made for a warmer and more intimate mood than the larger groups. She thought this over during the relative quiet of a visit to the restroom. Seeing Caitlin approaching in the hallway as she was on her way back out, she put the observation to her sensei to see what she made of it. Hearing it, Kate smiled the kind of smile she got when she was pleased with her student's insight and remarked, "You're right, Junie-chan. This is different. Take last night's pizza run, for instance. That was an after-party. This is more like a family gathering for a special occasion." She turned and cast a fond glance back at their table. "My birthday, yes, but also a celebration of a friendship, one that survived a 5-year attempt to smother it to death." Anne considered this for a moment, then smiled. "Azalin would like that," she observed. "Yes, she would," Kate agreed. "We must remember to tell her about it when we get home." They parted there, Kate continuing on to the ladies, Anne heading back to her seat. Halfway back to her seat, she met Azana coming the other way. "Hey, kiddo, you want to give me a hand for a second?" she asked. She gestured toward the counter, up onto which the head cook had just muscled a large basket. "The kitchen's put together a fruit basket for Mogi." "Sure," said Anne, nodding. They went to the counter and lugged the heavy basket outside, Anne discreetly helping out with her TK. Mogi was lounging in the alley around the side of the restaurant, near a window that looked in on the dining room, and was very pleased to receive his gift of fruit. "Well," said Azana, after they'd put the basket down in front of him, "that wasn't so bad." "Nope," Anne agreed, smiling slightly to herself. She suspected Azana would be as okay with telekinesis as she'd been with pyrokinesis, but best to approach these things gradually. There was a time and place for that sort of revelation. A burst of laughter emanating from the window drew their attention. From here they had a clear sightline to the table where Corwin and Cora sat. They couldn't hear the conversation from this far away, but judging from their body language, it had something to do with a reminiscence of some shared experience or another. Cora had her arm around Corwin's neck again, playfully pretending to punch him on top of the head, as he blatantly failed at fending her off. Azana smiled fondly, an expression very similar to the one Kate had worn when surveying them from a distance. "It's good to see Cora enjoying herself so much," she said. "Not that she's been morose lately or anything," she hastened to add, "but it's been a while since I saw her in a position where she felt able to be so completely unfiltered. Dealing with the younger crowd, people like Karana and me, she sometimes seems as though she's holding herself back, possibly out of a sense that she ought to be providing more of an example. Master Caitlin's brother seems to just unlock all that." She smiled. "It's a good thing." "You won't get any argument from me," said Anne cheerfully, and they left Mogi to his fruit and went back into the restaurant. On the way back to their table, to which Kate had returned while they were gone, Azana's sharp eyes spotted a figure sitting at the end of the counter. "Don't look now," she told the others as she slid back into her seat, "but I think you're being watched." Corwin raised an eyebrow. "Earth Kingdom girl, about so high, green dress?" When Azana nodded, Corwin only smiled, surprising her a little. "Yeah, you don't need to worry about her." Then he got his own confirmation as, though he hadn't turned to look, Emily Wong suddenly appeared in his field of vision, hurrying past on her way to the door. She spared him only a glance, the merest flicker of eye contact, as she passed, but the look she gave him was such a dark, reproachful one that it took him quite aback for a moment. "Where's she going in such a hurry?" Anne wondered. "Probably just got tipped off about Utena and Anthe at Kwong's," Kate suggested with a slightly evil smile. Corwin considered this, looking even more puzzled. "Maybe. That doesn't explain why she'd give me the how could you look, though." Cora sighed. "Yeah, I get the feeling there's going to be a lot of explaining to do at your meetup." "Hey, we promised her a good story. We never said it'd be a simple one," Corwin quipped. Utena and Anthe didn't see Emily on their way back from Kwong's to the ferry port. She arrived at the restaurant just after they left and guessed incorrectly which route they'd taken to the ferry. By the time she arrived there, the early evening boat had just pulled away from the quayside and out into Yue Bay. The reporter saw the distinctive colors and shapes of her quarries on the boat's foredeck, too far away to hail, sighed, and trudged away. The sun was setting behind Air Temple Island, casting the temple tower into silhouette, as the ferry sailed westward through the glassy twilight calm. On the foredeck, Utena lounged back against the rail and admired her wife's serenely smiling profile, rendered in burnished copper by the sunset. "How goes?" she asked, much less fussily than she had in some time. After this perfect evening, she felt warm, relaxed, utterly on top of the game, ready for anything. "Fine, nothing to report," Anthe replied, still smiling out across the bay. Then, just before Utena could respond, she added in exactly the same offhanded tone of voice, "It's barely even gotten interesting yet." "Good, good," replied Utena. And then, when her reactions caught up with her perceptions a moment later, "Wait, what?" She straightened up and turned to face Anthe. "What's barely gotten interesting?" she said in her don't-be-messing-with-me-now voice. Anthy glanced at her, then turned her eyes back to the sunset.
The contractions are still a good 10 minutes apart. I doubt I'm even fully dilated yet, though it shouldn't be long now.
Utna blinked at her, feeling proud of herself for not experiencing the sudden-onset blind panic all the standard comedy tropes called for at this time. In fact, she was still quite calm about the whole thing, calm enough to give Anthy a sardonic eyeing rather than commencing to witter and fret.
"And how long has this been going on?" she inquired.
Anthy looked thoughtful for a moment, as if calculating in her head, and then replied,
18 hours, give or take. I didn't make a note of the exact time."
Utrina looked around at the open deck on which they stood.
"And you've just been walking around that way all day, without mentioning it to anyone."
Anthy shrugged.
"I told you," she said calmly. "It's barely interesting to me so far, let alone anyone else. People would have gotten all excited for no reason. Caitlin's birthday dinner would have been spoiled. We wouldn't have gone to Kwong's. It would all have been terribly dreary."
She turned a cheerful smile to her husband and went on,
"As it is, we've all had a lovely day, and no one has had to fuss unnecessarily."
Utna arched an eyebrow at her, then said,
"I see. And would it now be unnecessarily fussy of me to lens Corwin and let him know that things will be happening soon?"
Anthy shook her head.
"Not at all," she assured Utna agreeably. "That would be a perfectly appropriate thing to do at this stage."
"I'm so glad I'm doing it right, then," replied Utna dryly. Anthy patted her arm.
"I've always had faith in your ability to improvise, my love."
Utna rolled her eyes and concentrated on her lens.
"Corwin," she thought, "are you back on the island yet?"
"No," Corwin replied. "We're just leaving Naruk's. Why?"
"I hope Mogi's had a nice nap, because he's got work to do," Utna quipped with a wry mental grin.
"Anthy and I are on the ferry now, and when we get in, it's showtime."
"Exclamation point," said Corwin. And then, in that everybody-get-ready-for-action tone that always gave her a thrill, "I will see you there."
"And I," Cora's psychic voice put in, to Utrina's considerable surprise, "will be with you shortly." Emerging from Naruk's at something just short of a run, Corwin nearly ran smack into Emily Wong.
"I have questions that need answering," she said flatly. And even under the circumstances, he had to respect the directness of her approach, at least respect it enough not to just brush past her and get on with the business at hand without even bothering to acknowledge it. Instead, he told her with equally disarming forthrightness,
"And you've earned a few answers, but I can't give them to you right now. Important things happening. Excuse me." Then, while she was parsing the first part, he stepped around her and into the side alley. Recovering quickly, Emily moved to pursue him, but a hand on her shoulder stopped her and drew her back.
"Not the time, Miss Wong," said Cora.
"Okay, I can be flexible. Let's start with you, Avatar," Emily retorted. Cora gave her a puzzled look.
"Me?" she wondered, then continued, "Since when was I a great mystery to be solved? Look, you heard the man. Time is tight right now, for very personal reasons that have nothing to do with news. But you won't be left hanging much longer, I promise."
With that, she rummaged in a front pocket of her messenger bag, took out a card and a pen, jotted a short message on the back of one with the other, and handed the card to Emily. "Come to Air Temple Island on the Friday midday ferry and give this to the first air acolyte you see," she said.
We'll sit down with you then and tell you the whole story. Don't come tomorrow. We'll be too busy to talk. Okay?
What? No, Emily protested. It's not okay. Just because you're the Avatar doesn't give you the right to...
This isn't about me being the Avatar, Korra cut her off. It's about me being there for my friends. Now, I've given you my word that you'll get your story. That's the best I can do, and I don't have time to stand here and argue with you about the details. Come to the island on Friday.
Then she, too, sidestepped the young reporter and went into the alley. Leaning in through the side window, she called thanks to the staff of Narooks, then turned toward Mogi. Before she could start climbing up to the saddle, she noticed Azana standing next to the bison and said,
Come on, up you get. Don't tell me you're afraid of heights.
I wasn't assuming I was invited, Azana replied.
Of course you are, said Korra, commencing to climb. Besides, I'm probably going to need your help with crowd control.
Azana climbed after her, looking confused. You'll be on Air Temple Island. What kind of crowd are you expecting?
You do realize how many air kids are on that island, right? Korra asked wryly.
I'm not about to go earthbending all the doors and windows to keep him at bay. Jinora would give me that look again.
No more than 5 minutes after Utana's call, the great cream-colored bulk of Mogi swept past overhead. As the bison passed, Korra stepped to the back of the saddle and jumped overboard, arching her body in a nicely executed swan dive before arrowing into the water a few yards off the ferryboat's starboard bow. Anthy waved gaily to Corwin and the small group of people still on the saddle, unrecognizable in the gathering dark, as Mogi sped away toward the island, moving faster than Utana had ever seen him go. Seconds later, the sea near where Korra had gone into the water began to roil and froth. Then the Avatar rose from the depths atop a waterspout of her own making, which was, Utana had to admit, a very stylish way of making an entrance on a boat. It deposited her neatly on deck a few feet away from the Tenjos, then curled away and fell harmlessly back into the bay, its energy dissipating. Utana noticed that her clothes weren't even wet.
So, she said cheerfully, the time approaches, eh? How long?
18 hours, Anthy replied, still with her same calm smile. Or thereabouts.
Well then.
Korra turned and hailed the quarterdeck, where the ferry's captain and first mate had evinced no particular surprise at the sudden and dramatic appearance of the Avatar aboard their vessel. Being air acolytes, Utana supposed they were used to that kind of thing by now.
What do you say, Captain? Shall we take things up a notch? Korra called.
We're ready when you are, Avatar, the captain shouted back.
All righty, then.
Korra turned to face forward again, then struck an airbender's starting stance and said with a grin,
Let's go to Force 5, shall we?
As she began to move her hands, the light breeze that had been scudding the ferry along began to freshen, picking up until it whistled in the rigging, the boat's sails bellied rigidly out. The ferry's speed immediately began to pick up, creamy foam rolling back from her cutwater.
This is pleasant, but it's really not necessary, Anthy murmured to Utana.
Oh, let her have her fun, Utana replied, smiling.
If you insist, Anthy said, but...
She paused, a thoughtful look coming onto her face.
Oh, bother.
Utana arched an eyebrow at her.
Himemia, pro tip. Bother is among the last things anybody whose wife is in labor wants to hear her say.
Oh, it's nothing serious, Anthy told her. I just rather hoped I'd have a chance to get out of this lovely dress before this stage arrived.
Huh?
Oh.
Ah, well. It's mostly water. It'll wash out.
Seeing the look coming onto Utrina's face, Anthy smiled a little wickedly.
"Ah, now you're starting to look a little peaked, darling. I was beginning to wonder."
Utrina cracked an only slightly wan smile and put a hand on Anthy's shoulder.
"I know it is. I've read all the same books you have," she said, looking her wife in the eye. "But right now I need to hear you tell me this is perfectly normal."
"This is perfectly normal," Anthy replied agreeably. "In fact," she added, "it's quite a good sign." "And no," she added before Utrina could say the next thing on her mind, "you don't need to ask Cora if she can make the boat go even faster."
Utrina gave her a mock pugnacious look, then laughed.
"Fine, okay." The ferry docked at Air Temple Island minutes later, and as they disembarked, Cora didn't fail to notice what had happened while she was busy speeding their passage.
"Right on schedule," she said, unfazed.
"Should we get a palanquin or something down here?" Utrina wondered. "That's a lot of stairs."
"Best thing to be doing at the moment, actually. Walking," Cora said. "If you feel up to it. Some do, some don't."
Anthy nodded.
"Let's go," she said.
Jinora and Iki met them at the quayside. As they all began the climb from the dock up to the temple complex, the former reported that Corwin and his team were already above, helping the acolytes prepare the Air Temple Infirmary's birthing room.
"Is he in fact helping?" Utrina wondered dryly. "Or just getting in the way?"
"Actually, he's very calm just at present," said Iki. "He's always been at his best with a situation to manage, after all," she added with a wink.
Utrina laughed.
"True," she conceded. Then, nudging Anthy gently with an elbow, she said, "Hey, Cora said you moved like an airbender the other day. Now you'll get to give birth like one, too."
"The standard around here nowadays is more of a hybrid air nomad water tribe style, for obvious reasons," Iki noted. Then she grinned and went on. "If you really wanted to do it in the old school air nomad style, you'd get on Mogi and see how far east you can get before the baby comes. The ancients called it dawn chasing."
Anthy smiled.
"Tempting," she said, "but I don't think we need to go quite that far in search of the authentic experience."
As Cora had predicted, a small crowd had gathered at the Air Temple Infirmary by the time she and the rest of the ferry group arrived there. Mogi, still saddled up, had stationed himself near the main entrance, next to a window, ready to move out at a moment's notice if a run to one of the city hospitals was called for. Anthy paused to thank him for his thoughtfulness before they all headed inside. The birthing room lay at the end of a wide corridor lined with benches, obviously intended to serve as a waiting area. Here, Milo and Rohan were doing their best to corral the island's youngsters, many of whom had turned out from sheer curiosity. At the far end, flanking a double sliding door, stood Maki and Izumi of the Kyoshi Warriors, fully kitted out in their most formal attire, as they had been at Utrina and Corwin's wedding. They both bowed deeply to Anthy as she approached, and then Maki slid open the door and stood aside, just the slightest twinkle of a smile showing through her game face. The room itself turned out to be the same sort of space as every other room in the temple complex Utrina had so far seen. Which was to say, it looked more like a dojo or Zen meditation chamber than a place where serious medical business was undertaken. It was a large, open, airy place that had a sense of orderly peace about it, with cheerfully pale-colored walls, dark wood trim, a smooth stone floor, and occasional plants. Unlike any dojo, though, it was dominated by a large, semi-sunken pool or tub in the center of the room, This was easily big enough to accommodate 3 or 4 people, and outfitted with a couple of ledges on the outside of its low perimeter wall, where still others could sit within reach of the action without actually being in the water. Here they found Corwin and the rest, completing final preparations. Nima stood off to one side, thoughtfully inventorying the supplies in one of the several lacquered cabinets. Near the back of the room, Lakpa stood close by Nal, as he, in turn, stood next to the open chest containing Matalde's egg and consulted with Corwin. Kate and Anne were nearby, talking with Amy and Rory, while Azana hovered near them, looking slightly at a loss. Seeing Cora enter with Anthy and Utna close behind, a few advanced to express their hopes that everything went well, some awkwardly, others with the easy confidence of old friends. "All the supplies are in order, Lady Anthy," said Nima with a smiling bow. Anthy returned the smile and made the airbender salute, though she didn't bow. "Thank you, Master Nima." Then, her smile becoming slightly wry, she said, "Hopefully when this is over, we'll have moved beyond titles." Nima blushed slightly and said, "I'd like that. Spirits protect you." When their turn came to wish Anthy well, Rory glanced a silent question at Amy, who gave it a moment's consideration, then nodded. Anthy saw the exchange and gave them a questioning look of her own. "How far apart?" Rory inquired, his tone of voice unusually clinical. 8 or 9 minutes, I should say," Anthy replied. "I haven't been timing them exactly." "Hmm. May I?" he asked, reaching for her wrist. Slightly puzzled but game, she nodded. He took hold of it gently, positioning his fingers just so, and consulted his wristwatch, timing her pulse. "Amy," he said as he was doing that, "I need you to run to my room in the men's quarters and get my bag. The small one. It's in the top of my suitcase." "On it," Amy replied briskly. With a reassuring smile and a pat on the shoulder for Anthy, she left the room at a brisk trot. When she returned, less than a minute later, she was carrying a small black leather bag, which she handed to Rory without a word. "Why do you have a doctor's bag?" wondered Utna, who had been watching the entire exchange with an air of slight bemusement. "Because I'm a doctor," Rory replied, as if that wasn't a strange thing for a high school sophomore to be saying. "It's a long story. Not an OBGYN," he added with a faintly self-deprecating smile, "but I'd be happy to provide backup if no one objects." "Remember on Tau Ceti, I said we were here to help?" Amy asked. "Well?" Anthy chuckled. "You two are full of surprises," she said. "I welcome any help I can get at this point, believe me." "Well, okay then," said Utna, chalking it up as one more thing she'd have to adapt to this evening. "What's up?" Corwin wondered, breaking away from his consultation with Nal. "Turns out we should have been calling Rory Dr. Pond this whole time," said Utna with a wry smile. "Really? Huh. Bet there's a story there," said Corwin with a slight smile. "You have no idea," said Amy with an eye-rolling grin. "Well, if you guys don't object, I sure don't," said Cora. "I'm not anticipating that we'll need one, but I'd never complain about having an MD standing by at a time like this." "Corwin?" asked Utrin. "Anthy's call," he said at once, and when she nodded with a smile, he went on, "I guess you're hired." "Okay, boys and girls, this is where I get unusually businesslike," said Cora, unusually businesslike. "Some of us have to get changed for the show." She took off her boots and stood them by the door, then padded barefoot back to the tub.
"Corwin, Utena, that means you too. You're going to get wet. Trunks and whatnot in that cabinet there," she added, pointing, "if you didn't think to bring your own. The rest of you will please withdraw. What happens next is not a spectator sport."
"Not you, Mrs. Williams," she corrected herself, as Amy kissed Rory for luck and made to retire with the rest.
"Dr. Pond may need a runner."
"Oh, and keep an ear on the egg, please," Corwin put in, pointing to the chest. "If you hear it cracking, that'll be your new job. I'll talk you through it."
Amy nodded, evidently unfazed that she might be called upon to midwife a dragon hatching in the middle of everything else.
"Got it."
"Right then," said Cora as the last of the well-wishers filed out. She went to one of the supply cabinets and took out a generously cut short-sleeved shirt, almost like a surgeon's scrub top, in the standard issue Air Nomad yellow, then crossed and presented it to Enthi.
"Let's get you out of that dress, Mrs. Tencho, and see what's what."
With most of the people evacuated and those who remained fully attuned to the business at hand, the atmosphere in the birthing room was serious but not tense. Corwin and Utena retired behind a screen and returned a few moments later, he in swim trunks, she stripped down to sports bra and bike shorts, the way she used to do for basketball as a teenager. Anthy changed from her Ming and daughter's finery, carefully arranged on a hanger to be taken away and cleaned, into the yellow shirt, which only covered her from mid-torso up.
"This is a PERSCAN, a personal scanner unit," Rory explained as he affixed a wide yellow plastic bracelet around Anthea's left wrist. "It'll relay a full set of diagnostic data on your vitals and the baby's to my tricorder."
He glanced up from his work and smiled. "Wonderful invention. Saves us both the annoyance of me waving around one of those wibbly scanner heads the whole time." Anthy returned the smile.
"Very clever," she agreed.
Listening to him explain what he was doing and why, Cora, busy performing her own checks of relevant situations in accordance with her training and experience as a Southern Water Tribe midwife, was suddenly struck by the oddest feeling of déjà vu. Rory Williams had been a stranger to her until only a few days ago. Until just a few minutes ago, she hadn't known he had any medical training at all. Nor, apart from Anthea's calm willingness to accept his word, did she have any real reason to believe that he did now. And yet she couldn't shake the curious feeling, as he spoke, that she had seen him do this kind of thing before. She shook it off and got on with the job, then reported,
"Okay, everything looks good. I suspect things are about to start happening a bit faster now."
She placed a palm against Anthy's abdomen, looking thoughtful, then raised her eyebrows.
"Strong," she said, smiling.
"Okay, let's get you in the water. Corwin, I'm going to need you in there, too. Your job's to make sure she can concentrate on what she's doing without having to worry about keeping her head above water."
Corwin blinked, looking on the verge of asking, "Me?"
He glanced at Utena, thinking, even after all that had to happen for them to get to this point in the first place, that perhaps he should defer the place to her. She was, after all, Anthy's actual husband.
"Get in there, you big dope," Utena's voice said through his lens.
She grinned at him, rolling her eyes slightly, and added,
"This one's all you."
Spotting his hesitation and not hearing Utena's remark, Cora smirked slightly and said, "Chop chop, tomorrow's sun. This is the part where stuff is happening." Corwin and Anthy situated themselves as instructed, he crouching catcher fashion with his back against the wall at the rear of the pool, she in his arms, sunk down to her chin in the warm water. At Cora's direction, Utena took up her post on the shelf-like seat to their right,
towel over her shoulder, ice chips at the ready. Rory stationed himself on the left with his tricorder in hand and a small row of spray hypos, each a distinctive shape and color, queued up on the bench beside him.
"We probably won't need any of these," he explained to Corwin's questioning look, "but if we do, it's best to have them ready to hand."
"Right," said Corwin, nodding. The scale of the situation in which he found himself seemed finally to be sinking in, but he was showing himself equal to it. He wasn't getting glazed or showing any signs of incipient freakout, but rather maintaining an even strain. He even managed to crack a wry grin for Uchna as he settled himself in for the duration.
"Everybody ready?" Cora wondered.
"Ready and willing," Anthy reported, then added wryly, "So that only leaves a question mark next to Abel." Cora smiled.
"You'll do fine," she said.
Then she took off her jeans. As was often the case, her snug-fitting top was really a one-piece swimsuit, and climbed into the other end of the tub, facing Anthy. Once in position, she closed her eyes, took a couple of deep, slow breaths, and then spread her hands over the surface of the water. In response, it began to glow, ever so faintly, a pleasant blue glow that reminded Corwin, a bit unnervingly, of Cherenkov radiation. The glow brought with it a faint tingling and a sensation of immense well-being, amplified in his case because there was nothing actually wrong with him. As Korra's waterbending talent charged the water around them with healing energies.
"This is how we do it at the South Pole," she said with a little smile in response to Anthy's widened eyes.
Then, clapping her hands briskly together, she went on, "Now for the interesting part." The atmosphere in the infirmary corridor outside the birthing room was a strange combination of festive and tense, like a low-key party everyone is slightly afraid might go wrong. Jinora and Milo had packed most of the youngsters off to bed within the first hour or so of the vigil, apart from Tenzin and Gyatso, who had insisted that they had to stay and keep interceding with the spirits. This they did with such a quiet and sincere intensity that the elders decided to leave them to it. Lakpa and Nal were together near the door, huddled in the soft, comforting arc of Neri. No one seemed to find that worthy of comment, not even the elders. Once the children were sent on their way, they all settled into meditative positions along one wall and lapsed into silence. Milo, it appeared, had actually fallen asleep. Anne sat on one of the long benches with Caitlin, Azana, and Nima, the last cuddling a slightly fretful Makoto the lemur. None of them saying very much, lost in contemplation of the moment and its implications. Anne, in particular, was pondering something she remembered reading in one of the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu's founding texts, Jedi Master Talar Kem's treatise on following the flow of the Force as it guides the course of one's life. The particular point on her mind had to do with potentiality and actuality, and how one could successfully surf the strange transition points between them. She wasn't sure how long she'd been meditating on that, perhaps an hour, perhaps two, when the door at the far end of the hall opened, and a familiar but somewhat unexpected figure entered. Lying at Kate and Anne's feet, Serge looked up at her entrance, then laid his head back down and sighed. Anne reached down and scratched behind his ear as Karana and Pabu made their way toward her and the others. "Hey, guys," she said, keeping her voice down in deference to the occasion. "Did I miss anything?" "Hey, Rana," said Azana, budging over a little to give her teammate room to sit down. "Nothing yet. It's only been a couple of hours, though." Karana nodded and took her seat. "Good, good. No news is good news at this stage," she agreed,
as Pabu disembarked and took up a station on Surge's head instead.
How did you get here? Anne wondered. Utina and Anthy were on the last ferry.
Swam, Karana replied casually. Took me longer than I was expecting, though. I don't know how Gran-Gran makes it look so easy. Oh, right. Avatar.
In the birthing room itself, matters proceeded in as calm and orderly a fashion as such matters could. Time ceased to have much meaning for the direct participants in the drama, particularly the parents of the impending child and their lover. Though still calm and in control of her emotions, Utina found herself in a peculiarly piquant kind of agony as she watched the woman she loved fight a battle in which she could have but the most peripheral part. She'd seen Anthy suffer before, and in much worse ways, ways which had no redeeming upside. But there, at least, she'd had the option of at least attempting to charge to the rescue, as was her wont. This time, no such option existed. The best Utrina could do was keep supplying her with ice chips as she requested them, placing them in her mouth in lieu of liquid refreshment. Beyond that offering, which felt a bit pathetically meager from where Utrina was sitting, there was nothing she could do but be there. This struggle was Anthe's alone. The sheer size of that realization was almost more than Utrina's crusading heart could bear. At one point, during one of the ever-shortening breathers she received, Anthy looked to her right and saw the stricken look in her husband's eyes, divined that entire train of thought, and, slightly to her own horror, found it almost paralytically funny. The look of shocked, slightly offended dismay her uncontrollable giggling evoked was even worse than the expression that had caused it. It was all she could do to stammer out an apology, still laughing.
"Don't take it personally," Rory advised from the other side of the tub. "A woman's neurochemistry gets a bit strange at times like this. She literally can't help it."
The next contraction cut off the laughter like a gunshot in a theater. When it was over, Anthy's mood seemed to have stabilized. She turned apologetic eyes to Utrina and started to tell her how much she appreciated her being there. But this, to Utrina's renewed dismay, tipped her the other way down the hill into a full-on crying jag.
"This is also perfectly normal, just so you know," Anthy sobbed.
"Yes, it is," Rory confirmed. He consulted his tricorder, then looked across the tub at Utrina and nodded. "She's fine."
"This must be what drugs are like," Anthy mused. "Frankly, I don't see the appeal."
They all rode out a couple more of those cycles over the next hour or two. While Corwin kept the air available, Utrina kept the ice chips coming, Amy fulfilled the federal pacing up and down requirement, periodically checking the egg, which, slightly to her annoyance, continued to do nothing. Rory monitored systems, and Cora maintained a running stream of encouragement and status updates. Corwin began to feel that he wouldn't be that surprised if it was daylight when he finally left this room again, or if he found himself on a different planet when he stepped through the door.
"All right, not long now," said Cora at length. "A couple more like that one and we're in business."
Corwin shifted his embrace around Anthy a bit as she let out a low groan and nearly doubled over in the water face first, her unheld left hand slipping from the edge of the pool.
"She's wiped out," he thought, leaning to kiss the corner of her jaw, as Utrina, by now looking genuinely rattled, did the same to the knuckles of Anthy's right hand. "I should be wiped out," he added to himself, as his thighs gave a twinge of protest, but only a twinge.
I've been holding this stance for how long now?
That's it. We're almost there, Cora declared. No, Corwin, don't look. Just hold on another few seconds. Right. Okay. Anthy, bear down hard.
Anthy took a deep, shuddering breath. Corwin felt the ripple of effort under his hands as she pushed down with every muscle in her abdomen. Then she let out a ki that nearly shattered the windows.
Ha-ha! Said Cora, evidently delighted. Good work. One more, Anthy, then you can rest for a bit.
One more, Anthy murmured, an exhaustedly sardonic smile touching her face.
Right. Sure. Can always do one more.
Then she took another deep breath, hesitated for an instant, and applied herself once again. As one last great shuddering wave went through Anthy, Cora made a pleased noise and looked up.
Congratulations, she said, beaming. It's a girl.
We knew that, Anthy mumbled, rolling her head back against Corwin's shoulder and blinking punch drunkenly up at the ceiling. Cora chuckled.
Of course you did, but it's traditional. Okay, Corwin, you help her over to the bench there,
and she pulled a small, dripping, squirming mass out of the water, pink and white and brown and still connected, and Corwin felt everything go slightly out of focus for what was really the first time tonight. Cora took one look at him and laughed.
Okay, plan B. Dr. Pond, you help Anthy. Utna, help your husband sit down.
Corwin could never quite remember exactly how he and Anthy ended up on the wide padded bench along the back wall, snuggled together under one of those amazing bison wool blankets with this small, squirming, burbling item that couldn't quite seem to look at anything, flailing about with tiny arms and legs. He dimly remembered there had been a few more operations, the details of which his memory had quite considerately refused to take serious hold of. But mostly what he remembered was the tiny, confused expression on his daughter's, little face, and the exhausted, contented glow on Anthy's.
You and me both, kid, he thought.
After a few moments of just sitting there basking in whatever in the universe this sensation was, Corwin returned at least partly from his astral voyage to the bottom of the sea and looked around the room. Amy, Rory, and Cora had gone, presumably to give the well-wishers out in the hall the news, but Utina was standing a few feet away, regarding the three of them with a deeply strange expression on her face. It took even Corwin, as familiar with her moods and feelings as anyone who wasn't her could be, a few moments to untangle everything he saw on that face. Love, yes, and pride, relief, but also a nervous hesitancy that was almost completely out of character for her, and just a dash of... Could that possibly be fear? What of? Oh, he thought. Of course. Then, with a warm smile, he opened his free arm, lifting the blanket away from his shoulders, and gestured with that hand for her while he touched her lens with his. Get in here, you big dope. This isn't all me. Utina's cheeks went a little red, but the balance of emotions in her face changed to favor relief and love as she crossed the awkward distance and joined them on the bench. Anthy looked up, blinking out of a light doze, at the movement as Corwin resettled the blanket around all four, then smiled and reached across him with the arm that wasn't cradling the child to touch her hand.
Hi, Utina said quietly.
Hello, my love, said Anthy wearily. Have you met our daughter?
The awkward look coming back onto her face, Utina reached over and very tentatively touched one of the tiny hands.
Hello, she said.
That was the royal hour, by the way, Corwin murmured in Utina's ear. Then he added wryly, remember the original plan, where I was just going to drop off some DNA and then head home?
Utina snorted and headbutted him very lightly.
Not so much now, she said.
No, Corwin agreed, contemplating his, their, all of their child again.
She was starting to resolve for him now, to come into focus as a person, or at least the prototype for one. She had light brown skin, midway between her parents' colors. Logical, but, he knew, not inevitable. And now that her short ruff of hair was starting to dry, it appeared as though it would be a slightly lighter shade of violet than Anthy's. But she had the same emerald green eyes, which now looked more or less back at him with an air of mild, abstract interest. Inasmuch as he could read her infant affect at all, she seemed less confused than she had at first. Corwin had never really considered it before, but he supposed it must be dismaying to suddenly barge into the world this way. He didn't remember doing so himself, but it stood to reason. That it seemed to have passed so quickly, replaced with this sense of quiet, intrigued contemplation, spoke well for the child's adaptability, if in fact that was what any of this meant. This was, after all, a completely new system, not previously tested. It would take a while for him to develop an algorithm for decoding the output. No, he repeated softly. Not so much now. The door opened far enough for Cora to slip through and close it behind her. Sometime while Corwin wasn't entirely present, she'd put her trousers back on. Now she walked quietly, still barefoot, over to the bench, then crouched before them.
There's absolutely no hurry, said Cora, but when you're ready to move again, we'll take you someplace where you can get some better rest than you'll get in here. It'll be better for seeing visitors, too.
She angled a thumb back over her shoulder at the door. In the meantime, Nima's keeping the rampaging horde at bay. Then, leaning a little closer, she smiled at the baby.
Hello, she said, her tone of voice hushed but normal, as if she were speaking to an adult.
Then she turned the smile to Anthy and asked quietly,
"What's her name?"
"Annabelle," said Anthy, touching the child's forehead gently.
"That was Dad's mother's name," Corwin mused.
"I know," Anthy replied. Utina considered for a moment, then smiled and said, "Annabelle Cora, if you don't mind." Cora blinked at her, a hint of a blush coming into her cheeks. Then, seeing that Corwin and Anthy had both responded with smiling nods, she closed her eyes, leaned in, and kissed Annabelle lightly where Anthy had just touched her, murmuring, "It's my honor." Annabelle tried to grab one of her side locks, but couldn't quite manage an act that ambitiously coordinated at less than 30 minutes old, and ended up vaguely punching her godmother in the cheek instead, which drew a giggle from all three of her parents, and Cora as well.
"Oh, it's going to be like that, is it?" said the Avatar with a grin. She ruffled the child's sparse hair and straightened up.
"Come on, let's get you guys into a proper bed." She winked cheerfully at Anthy. "Gonna be time for breakfast pretty soon."
Avery Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword No. 5, Suite for Trinity and Avatar,
The Dicho Suite. Second movement, What's Past is Prologue. The Dicho Suite will continue in the third movement. Goodbye and hello, as always.